a word, I should say that our technology has been the tree off the Northican child for a century and more. This is not necessarily true in Europe. The relation which a European child has to similar toys and so on is different. He has another, perhaps, area of recognized art and poetry that is not quite the same as technology. On the other hand, when a European comes to this continent, he is quite delighted with our whole technology. He regards North America as Disneyland. An adult tends to approach the technological world too visually to get its poetry. The child enjoys it through all his senses, synesthetically, by total involvement. Well, any situation that you enjoy by deep involvement with all your faculties and all your powers becomes a poetic situation. The child who likes to lie down and put his eye at the track level, this is stepping up the degree of involvement and participation in the activity. The worm's eye view is, from any cameraman's point of view, the most involving. The train to the child is a poetic world, of course, that it's like some reconstructed monster from some distant age. It's utterly quaint. It's like westerns on TV. It's a remote and a historic world. Now, this is a world, by the way, that in which children feel far more commitment than adults, practically minded, very little involvement in technology. Children with their deep involvement feel a real passion about older technology and older things. We're moving into a time when the reconstruction of ancient technologies, well, you know the cults of the early motor cars, is a passion because it permits a kind of involvement in the human community and in the human past of experience that is altogether fascinating for many people. Total involvement.
You have four of them.
We only have one.
It's striking that the children working with materials of this sort are giving themselves their own reward. Their curiosity is exercised. They are looking for the answers to things, and when they find it, that's their reward. They don't need gold stars or approbation. They should get these in some sort of a long-run thing. They also sense as they move along an increase in their own competence. And this is pretty heady, that this is what keeps one moving. This is one of the basic ways in which you have to fight what I want to call the sort of middle dropout, the kid who drops out of sheer boredom because he's never had a decent intellectual experience in the classroom. And they're getting an intellectual experience.
We're in the laboratory in a double sense. We're trying to import the laboratory into the classroom, and we ourselves are regarding the classroom as a laboratory. I would say the pendulum is one of the classic examples of a system which requires a knowledge of all the laws of physics before you understand it adequately. We're just beginning to probe with this particular piece of equipment. The study of the properties of the pendulum is very close to the beginnings of the fundamental ideas of modern physics. And one sees here, first of all, a certain style of work, a certain attack on the part of a child, which we think is very important, that he be at this stage quite free to design his own way or to develop his own way of going into the subject. The pendulum itself has remarkable properties which go unnoticed, although it's a very common object around. There are pendulums all over, from the apples on the boughs of trees to the, as one child said, the tail of a dog.
I think that the important thing to bear in mind here is not only that they're learning some physics, and I'm not going to go into that, but that the kind of learning that they're doing now is of a kind that they can use, that they're getting it in a way that'll stick to their bones, if you will. They're taking observations, they're introducing to the observations some way of regularizing them, groping for their own way of stating the lawfulness of phenomena that they observe. We're trying to give them some sense of physics such that they can become their own physicists rather than being mere spectators. And this is what the nature of the learning is that's taking place. The great simplifications tend to be quite abstract. Getting some sense of the simplicities of nature, some of these grand simplicities, is precisely something that takes a while. And indeed, if anything is worth taking a while at, it is this. You cannot give them the sense of the simplicity of phenomena simply by saying how it goes. You've got to let them go through these exercises.
Oppenheimer is fond of saying, there are children here in the street who could solve some of my toughest physics problems because they have modes of perception which I have lost. The playground approach to physics or any other learning process is a really a transfer from the old curriculum of classified subjects and fragmented data, well processed, neatly packaged, a changeover into the world of discovery and of participation in the act of discovery, which is a producer orientation rather than a consumer orientation. I think this big watershed is occurring as a result of speed up of data.
The great thing about making a film loop in a cartridge is that you make it available even to the clumsiest people to put right into a machine and run off and look at again and again and again.
My feeling after showing a similar class, some loops about the pendulum, and feeling their reaction to seeing this film after they had been working for several weeks in the classroom with very similar equipment, my feeling was this was a very dramatic experience for the kids to see from the adult world a slightly more elegant presentation of the very material that they had been working with themselves, and they saw everything in these films. Whereas if you showed these films to children who'd never played with the pendulum, never done these kinds of experiments and so on, I think they would get almost no information and very little of pedagogical value from them. So I think the film has to be linked closely with the work.
Well, the great thing about the technology is that it can produce, or provide, let me say, it can provide experience which the child cannot have with the naked eye.
8mm loop film to me, which seems to be termed a concept film, the beauty of it to me, the fact that it is a single concept and it's within the range of each individual child and provides the opportunity for the child to go through it several times, and that it's uncluttered with the audio without any other influences, so that the child can concentrate entirely on what he's seeing, and it's training him in observation, I feel. One of the children mentioned to me that this allows them to be individualists. This way they can observe without word or sound, and they can interpret it for themselves in several ways. And this is something else that I particularly appreciate about the concept films, that they do lend themselves to a variety of interpretations. But I think they should be very available, that is, within each room, so that they can take them as they need them.
The very technologies we've been seeing in the classrooms speed up data to a speed where the independent and unrelated facts are unimportant compared to the patterns between facts. So we move from a world of mechanically classified and processed data into a world of pattern recognition and discovery.
Lowercase. Lowercase.
Tested ability from normal through gifted. Now, in our program taken as a whole, we have children who range in tested ability from educable retardate through the gifted child. in terms of social background, the children you're seeing are favored in terms of the cultural background of the families from which they come. So you're seeing somewhat superior children.
The children learn in the same general way, I think, that they learn to speak their own native language. That is, they learn inductively as opposed to being taught. There is a very close correspondence between the written and spoken forms of English and most other natural languages that have a written form. And it's a matter of making the proper transformations to go from the spoken form to the written form and back. In the various parts of the laboratory program, they're making these interconnections between the spoken and written form of the language. But the set of methods permit a great variety of approaches to the same basic situation. What, in the, perhaps the deepest sense of the word, comes naturally.
Indian buffalo hunt. Long ago, buffalo lived in the flatlands of the West. These flatlands are called plains.
Plains.
Plains. Hundreds of buffaloes lived on the plains in great herds. The plains were fine hunting grounds for the Indians. Golden Feather was a chief of the plains Indians.
That's the C in front of the H.
Chief of the Plains Indians. He had a son named Silver Feather. It was time for Silver Feather to go on his first buffalo hunt.
It's a peculiar situation that we are encountering a more inclusive kinds of technologies which involve more of the human being in the learning process, and we're confronted with a great many people of exclusive and departmentalized and specialist skills and attitudes toward learning who are not very friendly toward integral forms of learning. Any specialist is going to see to it that his specialty is protected against any invasion from any quarter. And so a fragmented people are great experts in sensing threats from more integrated forms of learning. They've got a very good thing. They've taken a long time to acquire this specialist skill, and they don't see why they should yield one inch to people with different methods. O.K. Moore's approach brings the whole method of teaching phonetic literacy or teaching literacy closer to the actual norms of learning speech itself, the spoken word, by involvement of the whole sensorium of sight and sound and movement and, involvement of the whole being. So it's not surprising that people would accept this as a more congenial form of learning, and certainly one much closer to the nature of language itself than that of the older forms of literacy.
I think in addition to whatever they learn in the sense of academic skills, that they are acquiring a sense of independence. They can tackle and handle difficult problems without waiting for somebody to provide a solution.
Haiku.
What does haiku mean, Tammy?
Haiku is Japanese poetry. Ivy on a wall, like wee little animals climbing to their home.
This kind of method would enable people of so-called slow and retarded characteristics to perform quite well. It also enables people of ordinary characteristics to perform very much better. So it raises the accelerates the general rate of intake and of learning and perception and grasp for all kinds of people. But by the simple, by bringing the learning situation closer to the situation in which we learn to speak in the first place, involving all of us. People would never learn to speak at all if all the senses weren't richly involved. Since television is not so much an extension of the visual power as of the tactile and involving power, Naturally, therefore, any form of language instruction which calls for much use of sight and sound, of touch and taste, altogether, ideally favored by television. So people who continue to look at television as if it were a sort of inferior or low-grade movie are missing the complete meaning and opportunity of television.
We need to understand what we mean by a right circular cone. The TV class will use the right circular cone this morning.
The South Carolina Educational Television Center presents Algebra 2 with Mrs. Rhoda Nugent-Beal.
Today we want to begin a study of a quadratic equation in two variables. The general form of this equation is ax squared plus bxy plus cy squared plus dx plus ey plus f equals zero if at least one of the coefficients a, b, or c is not equal to zero. Now this equation is the curve which results from intersecting a cone with a plane. I want to explain this to you in greater detail. So I want you to look at the geometric solid. Here we have a cone, and the base of this cone is a circle.
A mere visual simulation of classroom conditions is the last thing that television should be used for. And it is mainly being used to simulate classroom conditions of the old-fashioned type. It's like, you know, dealing with a motor car as if it were a horseless carriage. And still trying to imagine the horses there. In the first motor cars, there were places for buggy whips and various other equipment. And we are dealing with the new classroom, TV classroom, leaving all room for the vanished horse.
Now look at this test tube. Now, in this test tube, I'm going to place water. And in the front of the test tube, I'll place a cork to seal off the opening. Now, what do you suppose is going to happen with this cork as I heat the water? Watch carefully.
Natural tendency is to use any new technology for the old purposes. The current uses of television are to simulate the old-fashioned classroom. Not to exploit television, but to make it simulate something that was done earlier, before television. Naturally, therefore, there's a huge wastage of opportunity here. And I really don't have any strong feelings about this, because it's a situation that will tend to correct itself in time, but there's a lot of waste in the meanwhile. When the technology is introduced into a natural or unprepared environment, it has a startlingly different effect, doesn't it, from its intrusion into a highly technologized environment. It's like introducing a motor car into a primitive tribe. The North American Indians were not impressed by motor cars. They were fascinated by bicycles because the bicycle seemed to them a tremendous achievement. It was against nature, the fact that you could balance aeronautically, as it were, on two wheels, whereas four wheels on the ground meant nothing to them. But in terms of the extension of classroom or other prepared conditions into an area where there are no classrooms and no teaching and so on, it's incredible to imagine the effect it might have. It's like bypassing ages of technology, isn't it? It's like introducing a book into a pre-literate area, or introducing classrooms into areas where there had previously been no form of formal instruction at all. You have this strange hybridizing and conflict of cultures. A tribal, an ancient tribal world suddenly deeply involved in the latest Western technologies. it's a situation that we live with our own children in a way in the Western world. And they go through these stages of accustomation to our own technologies at a furious clip. Layer after layer, century after century of technology they take in a few months. And so we live with it ourselves, but to see it in the lives of other people is a new experience.
This is the first year we've used strip films in combination with radio. But to date, the results have certainly been very gratifying. We find a wide variety of uses and applications and feel that the future is wide open and very promising. Radio has proved more productive in the stimulation of original expression than television, because the imitative impulse seems to be so operative in television that we get back the same kinds of pictures that we show on television. The film strip provides a great deal of flexibility, and it seems to me avoids this imitative practice because it provides the classroom teacher with a tool, an instrument that she can use for her own class in a way which is most suitable for the particular group.
It's fascinating to see how the children responded in their artistic activities to an audio situation. Their work became less pictorial, less merely a matter of copying, less a matter of matching situation with situation, than a search for abstract form, for the language of forms. To give the visual form, the non-visual involving appearance is a considerable artistic feat. These kids were beginning to understand that by simply following auditory instructions for visual situations. The translation from one medium into another awakened their sensory life in a completely new way. I was quite surprised.
Well, we've had here at Phillips Academy at Andover for a number of years a program whereby all students are expected to have an experience of what we used to call art, but we are tending now to call visual perception. The idea being that so many people, so many citizens, are virtually illiterate as far as the eye is concerned, although they may be quite proficient, quite erudite in matters of communication by the accepted academic means. So from the standpoint of education, we feel it's extremely important to train the perceptiveness through the eye of every citizen. Specifically, this is done not only in terms of drawing or work with three dimensions, but also we find that the camera and the photographic medium apart from the camera is of considerable use, because it provides a very quick way in which a student can observe and, through observing, discover relationships which are not so easily come by in terms of drawing alone.
I don't want to take up much time introducing this film. It's quite short, but even so, the time is more useful when we have seen it and can discuss it afterwards. The point is, however, that you've been working with photograms downstairs and have discovered that the photogram is not quite the same as working with the true camera. It's a different kind of reality. In the same way, what you're about to see by Norman McLaren, you can relate, if you wish, to the work that you've been doing in the studio drawing, or the work that you've been doing down in the darkroom with photography, especially with regard to the photograms that you've been working with, as distinguished from the reality of the true camera. Let's look at the film, and we can talk about it later.
For centuries, the only kind of skill or grammar or literacy that was taught was that connected with the writing, reading and writing itself. All the other skills and technologies of the environment were accepted as merely environmental and taken for granted. Today, we have, because these things have stepped up in many of their developments, many of their manifestations, we have to understand the language and grammars of many media. And this is rather fantastic, isn't it, when you think of the number of hours that people spend in front of film or television, for them to know nothing about the processes of making these things, or nothing about the means available for themselves to express themselves. So the grammars of media has become this area has become a new area of stress in education. It's wonderful to see the results of those scratchings. They come out on the screen like Chinese, Japanese art forms. This is a tremendous discovery for the children, obviously, in the potential of a form right in their own hands. Like seeing oneself in print, like writing poems and seeing them published, somewhat the thrill that the O.K. Moore children get in seeing themselves learning to read and write by actually publishing themselves as they go, by typing. But the McLaren world makes a tremendous break with ordinary film in this way, that by painting directly onto the film, you make the audience, as it were, the screen, instead of making the audience the camera eye. And so the child then, by drawing directly onto film, has a sense of mastery over the whole world. It's like a composer writing a melody. He makes a world. The composer making a melody doesn't try to make a world that corresponds to some other world. He just etches or makes with sound a world. McLaren, when he draws directly onto film, makes a world. He isn't photographing a situation which corresponds to some other situation. So this switch from matching to making is a drastic one in terms of the learning process. It switches altogether, again, from classified data, from mere matching knowledge, to a world of actual discovery and actual knowing of forms. I think you couldn't find a larger switchover in the whole history of education.
I think that developing new techniques for developing visual literacy, that is a sense of form and texture, a sense of the concreteness of things experienced in a sensitive way, is one of the most essential parts of anyone's education, for which at present very little has been done except at a few experimental centers. A film which can present familiar objects in entirely new ways, can, by showing material in a perspective that we do not ordinarily see it, helps free us from the provincialism of whatever perspective has become habitual with us. It isn't only a matter of being presented with interesting perceptual effects, but it's also a matter of putting the learner in the position of creating new effects himself. And the special importance of photography is not only having professional photographers and artists working together to present new sensory experiences, but to have the learner use photographic equipment and keep a running record, as it were, of his own attempts to shape and form material in interesting, exciting new ways.
The film program at the Carpenter Center is made up of two equal parts. One is in animation, which is where we're situated now, obviously. And although this looks like a monstrously complex piece of equipment, it in fact is very simple once the elements of its design are understood. What it permits, really, is the animation of two-dimensional and three-dimensional objects. And we hope that, in a way, the stand will coordinate the activities of the center by making it possible for people working in two dimensions or working in three dimensions to put their objects into motion. The other part is not an orthodox film school curriculum. It's an attempt, really, to introduce people to the idea of film as a way of seeing things around them. And what we do is to work in 8mm in the initial course, and they're given specific assignments each week. They're given a different kind of an assignment, which is meant to introduce them to one facet of the power of film. Let's say slow motion or animated film. One of the things that I want to show you is the work done by a student who is continuing his experiment from last term in a special project in the animation of clay. This is with a simple camera. The idea of him working with cinema is the same as Mirko Bosaldella's ideas upstairs of them working with sculpture. It's to give them a new way of seeing things. Is to give them an opening on their environment, which they didn't have before. The possibility of them being television executives or even television directors is probably not as good as of them becoming poets or bankers when they leave Harvard, actually. But I think that once having taken these kinds of courses, where they are given a chance to see in a new way, that they will be more at least visual bankers than they were before. And if they're going to put up a bank building, maybe it's going to be a good-looking bank building instead of a bad-looking one.
Presumably, people tend to know least about the things they're most imposed upon by. There seems to be a mechanism of protective inhibition, so that people automatically seal off the areas where experience is maximal. They seem to know least about the areas that they are most involved in experientially. That is why perhaps this world of the Carbon Center is so exciting to a highly literate and highly retinally and visually oriented population. It's giving them back their other senses through the through a certain use of the visual sense, through a very tactile and low resolution use of the visual. They suddenly get people involved with their other senses in this world, and they begin to sense what is called plastic form again. Of course, it is a kind of primitivism. It is like a rediscovery of primitive values of the unsophisticated, the unprepared environment, the non-technological world. This kind of thing tends to go along with a great deal of sentimental overvaluation, perhaps, and a great deal of romanticizing of the primitive. This goes along with the kind of glorification of the primitive world of childhood, and so on, which is a natural reaction against a highly mechanized environment. We continue to talk about the mechanized culture of today. In fact, we have moved out of the mechanized world into the electric world without especially understanding the new dimensions of the electric world. It is one of involvement in the sense that people no longer merely are spectators of processes. They are very much now involved in processes, and therefore children love to get involved in making their own films and making their own programs. This kind of involvement is very natural to people in an electric world, because an electric world is one of circuits, of integral loopings and feedback.
I think they learned a little bit about the capture of York, and I think it added a bit of excitement to the history class. And this was one purpose for my shooting it, to add something exciting, something a little bit different, perhaps to try to compete with television in the history class.
Well, the best way to learn the grammar of any form or the way in which it is laid out is to get involved in using it and making it. Obviously, children engaged in making a film turn to look at films with brand new eyes. Hmm?
There it modulates a UHF transmitter.
So child of the future is a rather terrifying thought. It makes even science fiction look rather tame. What is, in effect, happening is a kind of extension not only of the learning process, but of consciousness itself into the outer environment, so that the child of the future is likely to be able to program consciousness with the same ease with which we have previously programmed curricula. But I can't be terrified by such prospects, really, because these are also extensions of man. They are not ways. They are means of becoming more oneself, rather than ways of becoming alienated from oneself. Now, you can't possibly imagine a technology except the most specialist fragmentary type that could possibly alienate man from himself. They amplify our powers. They accelerate our powers, and they enrich the learning process enormously.
It is received at Prince Albert after reflection.
I think that's it.